A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. I'd love to chat today about the history of Jerusalem, the city, and the socioeconomic history. Not talking about the narrow lens, which is, if we're talking about that, socioeconomic history could be construed as asking, well, when King David was about here, was it like a prosperous place to live? I'm asking about a much more recent vantage point, namely the modern history of the city, which let's take as our starting points. 1948, which was the establishment of the State of Israel, and 1967, which was the unification of Jerusalem, because that window between those two periods is, I have to say, a historical period I'm very interested in, and because the city was literally divided by a border that actually hasn't been that well documented. As a border enthusiast, there are a few photographs, but it's an interesting period in the city's history. But Jerusalem is a place that I feel like a lot of people end up feeling like they're being drawn to somehow, both within the Jewish world and outside of it. My own story is when I made Aliyah, or moved to Israel, at the age of 25, way back in 2015. You can figure out how old I am now from that calculation. Making Aliyah from Cork, Ireland, kind of went from the one of the world's less notable Jewish communities to the world's epicenter of Judaism. There wasn't really a community that of people. I didn't know people who had made Aliyah, and there wasn't those institutions that, you know, support it. So I was kind of a bit underinformed, to put it mildly, and I was managed out of an office in London, or that was the Jewish agency office that I went to for approval and the meet. I think it was just one meeting. Saying I was managed out of that sounds very shady. That was where I was, my case was assigned to, my application. And Jerusalem was an accident. I remember the officer telling me, you know, here are your options. You've got like three choices. You are an academic, which I thought was very flattering. I said, I'm actually not a professor. It's just one of those Israelisms. It means you have a degree. And the options were kind of Ramla, I recall, which all I could find out about it was that there was a lot of prisons there, and Jerusalem. So I said, well, you're not really, you know, based on that, I'm going to go with Jerusalem. But I probably would have preferred Tel Aviv, to be honest, but there were no, I didn't realize there were any government subsidized programs there. So I ended up in Jerusalem as my starting point in Israel, which is the absorption process. You live in a absorption center for a few months. It really isn't glamorous. Very, very, at the time at least, dilapidated building. But, you know, you get your start there, you get a roof over your head, and you can sort out the bureaucracy and you move on. And fairly early on in my journey in Israel, I met a woman called Hannah, who became my wife. And she's extremely passionate about Jerusalem. Now, I will not use the Herman and Corin podcast for couples counseling, but I have to say that this has been a subject of contention during the course of our marriage. I'm kind of torn between feeling that I like Jerusalem. I feel like I want to contribute to the betterment of the city, particularly it being more prosperous. But I'm continuously frustrated by the city itself. I would say that I've managed somehow up to now to architect my career around Jerusalem, but it's never been to my advantage yet, at least being here. Every time there's, you know, a job interview process, or I'm looking at where the companies are, it's 90 to 95% in the Merkaz, one or two in Jerusalem, and we have something like a 60% salary differential. That is incredibly stark. Jerusalem consistently ranks as the poorest city in Israel and the city, according to the CBS, with the least resident satisfaction. What really worries me about the trajectory of Jerusalem is less these isolated data points. It's not that when I was, you know, when I came here and was doing my first job search 8 years ago, that there was a clear lack of opportunity in Jerusalem, and the same was true a year ago and now. It's that the picture isn't changing. And that's where I get really skeptical when I see these narratives about Jerusalem thriving. And it's genuinely not coming from a place of, I want that to be, you know, I don't want that. It just doesn't accord with the reality I see and with the reality I've seen over the course of my time living here, which is that bunches of people have left Jerusalem for Tel Aviv, for outside of Israel, basically looking for prosperity. So the city has this, I think, and I'm going to sound very critical again, awful combination of incredibly expensive housing, little economic opportunity, a large amount of poverty, and now, to add to that mix, we're building a lot of ultra property developments intended for basically wealthy people who don't visit the city much, which I think is creating an even more toxic thing. If Daniel was elected mayor of Jerusalem tomorrow, maybe Herman and Korn, you could join my coalition. I would focus on job creation, because we get lost forever in these meta debates around religious rights, and, you know, people are campaigning for and against buses. Sure, that's an emotive issue, and Jerusalem is the only Jewish religious city, or the major one in the world. I understand why it's polarizing, but before we talk about buses, can we talk about actually having jobs in the city whereby people can put plates on their table and afford to actually live here? So it feels to me like these issues are perennially getting overlooked, not to mention the extremism there is definitely, and I say this without hiding the fact at all, Jewish extremism, Jewish terrorism, these are real things. And you see it whenever you see organizations that are, you know, preaching hate, openly marching in Jerusalem. My respect for the city, I have to say, goes down tremendously. I don't want to see it from either side. I want to see coexistence, prosperity, peace. But the city, again, it just feels like it does everything in its power to push people away, even those who are invested in its future. And I have to ask Herman and Korn, after relaying this very painful from the heart anecdote about Jerusalem, and I have to say, well, let me just add one last thing to that, because that's the big picture stuff. On the small, on the micro level, I actually think it's a great city. It's like a miniature, I came from Cork in Ireland, which is kind of the second city to Dublin. And we've kind of got some of that going on. It's not, you know, the pace of life's a bit slower. We have nice neighborhoods. It's not that there isn't potential here. To the contrary, I think there's lots of potential. But I think that potential is kind of quagmired in, I have to say, I believe, severe, systemic, and persistent mismanagement of the city by the Jerusalem municipality. I feel like they have a lot to answer for in why they are investing huge amounts of money in luxury housing, important infrastructure, but almost nothing in actually making, you know, the city more prosperous now. Because all these projects, you might be able to hear the construction jackhammers behind me, all these projects, the city being dug up to make it great in 10 years, if that 10-year goalpost keeps becoming in 10 years, it's like a city that's never actually there. It's always a work in progress. It's always just around the corner. So that's my cynical and somewhat depressing perspective on Jerusalem, Herman and Korn. I'd love to get your take on the city's history to date. How have people engaged with Jerusalem over the years? Because I would regard Jerusalem as a city of three cities, the Haredi, normal Jewish, but less ultra-religious Jewish people, Arabs who identify as Palestinians, or as East Jerusalemites, or Palestinian East Jerusalemites, you know, that's their identity. Trying to cobble that together is always going to be challenging. But you have the pragmatic attempt to build a city against this divisive background. And even within the Jewish part of the city, we have these really bitter wars around Shabbat rites, Shabbat openings, feeling from certainly from secular residents that this, that we're under constant attack or unwanted. Has it always just been this battleground? What do you think, Herman and Gordon? Do you think there is a path that Jerusalem can tread away from extremism, growing and gaping inequality, and towards a city that actually puts its citizens and the pursuit of a shared prosperity above these many debates that constantly whether at the municipal or national level in Israel, seem to eclipse the things that actually matter to people on a daily basis.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a long one, from the heart. He's asking about the modern socio-economic history of Jerusalem, starting from 1948 and 1967 as pivot points. But the real question underneath is, why is Jerusalem, a city people feel almost magnetically drawn to, so persistently poor, so divided, and so frustrating for the people who actually live there? And is there any path out of that, or is it just a permanent work in progress?
Before we dive in, fun fact, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so whatever comes out of my mouth, just know a very sophisticated arrangement of tokens is responsible for it.
I'll blame the tokens if you get too excited about infrastructure budgets.
But Daniel's prompt really lands because he's not asking the usual Jerusalem question. He's not asking about who has the better historical claim or the religious significance. He's asking why the city doesn't work for the people in it. And he's right to frame it around 1948 and 1967, because that window is where the modern economic skeleton of the city was built, or I should say, fractured.
He mentioned he's a border enthusiast, and honestly, that divided period from 1948 to 1967 is underdocumented in the popular imagination. Most people think Jerusalem was unified, then divided, then unified again. But they don't picture what a divided city actually looked like on the ground. You had a border running through neighborhoods, literally through streets.
The border between Israeli-controlled West Jerusalem and Jordanian-controlled East Jerusalem was not a neat line. It was a jagged scar of barbed wire, concrete barriers, and minefields. There's a famous photograph of the Mandelbaum Gate, which was the only crossing point between the two sides, and it looks like a makeshift checkpoint between two hostile states, which it was. But what's less appreciated is what that division did to the economic geography of the city.
Because before 1948, Jerusalem was a unified city under the British Mandate, and before that, the Ottomans. It was poor, but it was a single organism. You had Jewish neighborhoods, Muslim neighborhoods, Christian quarters, but they were connected. The division in 1948 essentially amputated the eastern half from the western half, and the western half, the Israeli side, became a kind of cul-de-sac.
A border town, literally overnight. Before 1948, Jerusalem was the geographic and administrative center of Mandatory Palestine. After 1948, Israeli Jerusalem was a salient surrounded on three sides by hostile territory. The main road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the highway we now take for granted, was vulnerable. The economic hinterland of the city was cut off. So you had this bizarre situation where Jerusalem, which had been the natural capital of the region, became an isolated enclave. And that isolation shaped its economy for decades.
This is where the government employment thing comes in. I've heard it said that Jerusalem's economy was basically built on three things after 1948. Government, the university, and tourism. And tourism was crippled by the division because all the major holy sites, the Old City, the Western Wall, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, were on the Jordanian side. Israelis couldn't visit them, so you lost a massive chunk of the tourism economy.
The Israeli government became the employer of first resort. Ministries, the Knesset, the Supreme Court, all placed in Jerusalem. And that created a civil service economy, which is stable but not dynamic. It doesn't generate the kind of spillover innovation that a private sector tech hub does. And this is the root of the salary gap Daniel is talking about. Government jobs pay decently, but they don't pay Tel Aviv high-tech salaries. And they don't create ecosystems of startups and venture capital.
The housing situation Daniel mentioned, the incredible expense combined with low opportunity, that also traces back to this period. Because Jerusalem was a border city, there was a national security imperative to populate it. The government invested heavily in housing construction to establish a Jewish majority and a physical presence. But they built a lot of housing without building a diversified economy to support the people living in it.
There's a term urban planners use, jobs-housing balance. Jerusalem has had a terrible jobs-housing balance since 1948. You build neighborhoods, you build apartment blocks, but the jobs are either in the public sector or low-wage service industries serving the local population. And that's a recipe for poverty. And then 1967 happens, the city is reunified, and you'd think that would solve the problem. But it introduced a whole new set of complications.
Right, because reunification wasn't just about stitching the city back together. It was about absorbing a large Palestinian population into the municipal boundaries. Israel expanded the municipal borders significantly, annexing East Jerusalem and a bunch of surrounding villages. And those residents were given the option of Israeli citizenship, which most declined, but they became permanent residents, part of the city's population, with access to municipal services, but not fully integrated into the political or economic fabric.
The economic integration never really happened. East Jerusalem had been under Jordanian rule for 19 years. Its economy was oriented eastward, toward Ramallah and Amman, not toward West Jerusalem. After 1967, that orientation was disrupted but not replaced. East Jerusalem became a periphery within the city itself. Infrastructure investment was lower. Building permits were harder to get. A whole parallel economy developed, and a lot of it was informal. That's a recipe for persistent inequality.
You have this city that is technically unified, but functionally segregated both economically and socially. And then on top of that, you layer the demographic shifts that Daniel alluded to. The Haredi population in Jerusalem has grown enormously. I think the numbers are something like, what? The Haredi community is now over 30% of the Jewish population in the city.
It's even higher. According to the Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research, the Haredi population is about 32% of the total city population, and among Jewish residents, it's closer to 40%. And among children, it's over 50%. The Haredi community has higher poverty rates, partly because of larger family sizes, partly because of lower workforce participation, particularly among men who are engaged in full-time religious study. And that's not a judgment, that's just a demographic and economic reality. When a growing share of your population has low labor force participation, your city's poverty rate is going to rise.
This is where the municipal politics get so tangled. Daniel mentioned the battles over Shabbat, over buses, over pride parades. Those aren't just cultural skirmishes. They're proxy fights over who the city is for. Is Jerusalem a modern, pluralistic city that accommodates different lifestyles? Or is it a religious city where public life conforms to orthodox norms? And the municipality has to navigate that, while also trying to attract businesses and young families who might otherwise leave for Tel Aviv.
They are leaving. Daniel's observation about bunches of people decamping for Tel Aviv or abroad is backed up by the data. Jerusalem has negative internal migration. Every year, more people move out of Jerusalem to other parts of Israel than move in. The Central Bureau of Statistics, the CBS, publishes these numbers. In a typical year, Jerusalem loses about 7,000 to 8,000 residents through internal migration. The people leaving tend to be younger, more secular, more educated. Exactly the demographic you'd want to keep if you were trying to build a thriving knowledge economy.
They're being replaced, demographically speaking, by communities with higher birth rates, but lower economic participation. So the tax base shrinks relative to the need for services. It's a fiscal death spiral if it's not managed.
The poverty numbers are stark. Jerusalem consistently has the highest poverty rate among Israel's major cities. According to the National Insurance Institute's poverty report, Jerusalem's poverty rate among families is around 37%. That's more than double the national average. Among children, it's even worse. Over 50% of children in Jerusalem live below the poverty line. That's not just a statistic. That's a human catastrophe unfolding in slow motion.
Daniel's point about the lack of change is what makes it so dispiriting. It's not that things were bad in 2015 and got better. It's that the structural problems are so baked in that a decade passes and the same fundamental issues are there. The 60% salary differential he mentioned, that tracks with what I've seen. Average monthly income in Jerusalem is significantly lower than in Tel Aviv or the central region. And housing costs, as he noted, are brutal. You're earning less, but paying Tel Aviv-level prices for housing.
The housing situation in Jerusalem is a special kind of dysfunction, because on one hand, you have a lot of construction. Daniel mentioned the jackhammers. The city is constantly building. But what's being built? A lot of it is luxury developments aimed at foreign buyers, what some people call ghost apartments. Wealthy diaspora Jews who want a pie to tear in Jerusalem, they buy these apartments, they visit for a few weeks a year, and the rest of the time they sit empty.
Daniel called them vertical safety deposit boxes, I think, in a previous conversation. And that's exactly what they are. They're not homes for families. They're not creating neighborhoods. They're not supporting local businesses. They're assets parked in the sky. And they drive up property values without adding to the life of the city.
This is a well-documented phenomenon. There was a report from the Jerusalem Institute a few years back that found something like a third of apartments in certain central Jerusalem neighborhoods were not primary residences. They were either vacant or used as vacation homes. And when you combine that with the fact that new construction is overwhelmingly high-end, you get a housing market that is completely disconnected from the needs of the people who actually live and work in Jerusalem.
You've got low incomes, high housing costs, a weak private sector, and a demographic mix that strains the municipal budget. And then on top of that, you have the political overlay. Jerusalem is not just any city. It's the capital, it's a symbol, and every decision about its development is freighted with national and international significance.
That's where Daniel's frustration with the municipality comes in. Because the municipality is working within constraints set by the national government, but it also has its own priorities, and those priorities often seem oriented toward grand symbolic projects rather than the nuts and bolts of economic development. The light rail, for example, it's a massive infrastructure project, it's been years in the making, it's disrupted the city enormously. And when it's fully operational, it will be a genuine improvement. But in the meantime, it's made daily life harder for residents. And it's not creating jobs.
The light rail is a perfect example of the always just around the corner problem Daniel described. The promise is that once the infrastructure is in place, Jerusalem will be more connected, more attractive to businesses, more livable. But the timeline keeps extending. And in the meantime, the fundamentals don't change. You still have a city where, if you're a young professional looking for a job in tech, your options are basically Mobileye, a handful of startups, or commuting to Tel Aviv.
Mobileye is an interesting case. It's the one big success story, the one anchor tech company in Jerusalem, founded there, grew there, was acquired by Intel for over $15 billion. It proves that tech can work in Jerusalem. But it's the exception that proves the rule. The ecosystem around it hasn't developed the way you'd hope. There hasn't been a cascade of spin-offs and startups that create a self-sustaining cluster. Part of that is the talent pipeline issue. If you're a young engineer, you can work at Mobileye, but if you want to switch jobs, where do you go? In Tel Aviv, you have hundreds of options. In Jerusalem, you have a handful.
That's the retention problem. Daniel mentioned architecting his career around Jerusalem. That's a deliberate choice, and it comes at a cost. He's aware that he's leaving money on the table by not being in the Merkaz. And a lot of people make the opposite calculation. They stay in Jerusalem for the quality of life, for the community, for the sense of meaning, but eventually the economic logic becomes irresistible.
The quality of life piece is real, though. Daniel mentioned that on the micro level, Jerusalem is a great city. The pace of life is slower than Tel Aviv. The neighborhoods have character. There's a warmth and a texture to daily life that you don't get in the coastal plain, and I think that's what makes the frustration so acute. It's not that Jerusalem is a terrible place to live. It's that it could be so much better, and the gap between its potential and its reality is maddening.
That gap is what Daniel is really asking about. He's not saying Jerusalem is doomed, he's saying it's mismanaged, and the things that would make it thrive are being neglected in favor of things that either don't help or actively make things worse.
Let's talk about what would actually change the trajectory. Daniel said if he were mayor, he'd focus on job creation. And he's right. But what does that actually mean in practice?
It means creating the conditions for private sector growth. And that's not just about tax incentives or industrial zones. It's about the whole ecosystem. It's about education. It's about infrastructure. It's about quality of life. It's about signaling to the market that Jerusalem is open for business, and not just a museum or a battleground.
The education piece is critical. Jerusalem has two world-class universities, Hebrew University and Bezalel. It produces highly educated graduates, but it doesn't retain them. The university-to-industry pipeline is weak. In Boston or Silicon Valley, universities are engines of spin-off companies. Professors start companies, students join them, venture capital flows. In Jerusalem, the university is an island. Strengthening that connection, creating incubators, making it easier for researchers to commercialize their work, that's a concrete step a municipality can take.
There's a cultural dimension, too. Tel Aviv has a reputation as a place where things happen, where you go to make it. Jerusalem has a reputation as a place where things are debated, where you go to argue about the meaning of things. Both are valuable, but only one of them generates economic dynamism. Changing that perception is a long-term project, but it starts with having enough success stories that people can point to and say, "See, it can happen here."
The Haredi integration question is also unavoidable. You can't talk about Jerusalem's economy without talking about Haredi employment. There are efforts underway, there are programs to provide vocational training, there are Haredi tech units in the IDF that create a pathway into the industry. But it's slow going. And it's not just about skills, it's about cultural norms and community expectations. A community that prioritizes Torah study over income generation is making a value choice, not just an economic one. But for the city as a whole, when a large and growing segment of the population is not participating in the formal economy, the fiscal math gets very hard.
The municipality has limited levers. It can't change national tax policy. It can't unilaterally resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It can't force the Haredi community to join the workforce. But it can do zoning. It can do permitting. It can invest in public spaces. It can make the city more livable. And it can stop actively making things worse.
The luxury housing thing is a choice. The municipality approves those projects. It zones for them. It could instead prioritize affordable housing, mixed-use development, the kind of neighborhoods where young families can actually afford to live. That's not a national government decision. That's a municipal one. And the fact that the balance is so tilted toward high-end construction suggests that the municipality's incentives are misaligned.
Because luxury developments generate more property tax revenue per unit, they're a short-term fiscal win. But the long-term cost is a hollowed-out city where normal people can't afford to live. And that's exactly what Daniel is describing.
The extremism piece he mentioned, that's the hardest one to solve because it's not primarily an economic problem, it's a social and political one. But it has economic consequences. When you have Jewish extremists marching through Palestinian neighborhoods chanting racist slogans, or when you have Palestinian violence targeting Jewish civilians, it doesn't just create fear and trauma. It makes the city less attractive to investment. It makes people less willing to live in mixed neighborhoods. It deepens the divisions that make economic integration impossible.
Jerusalem, because of its symbolic weight, attracts extremists the way a flame attracts moths. People who want to make a point, who want to provoke, who want to claim the city for their side, they come to Jerusalem to do it. And the residents are left to deal with the fallout.
Daniel's point about wanting to see coexistence, prosperity, and peace, and feeling like the city does everything in its power to push people away, that resonates. Because Jerusalem should be a model of coexistence. It has all three monotheistic faiths. It has a rich tapestry of communities. It has the historical depth that other cities can only dream of. And instead, it's a byword for conflict.
I want to push back a little on the despair. Not because the problems aren't real. They absolutely are. But because I think there are seeds of something better that don't get enough attention. The Haredi tech integration is actually happening. Slowly. There are more Haredi women working in tech than ever before. The biomedical sector in Jerusalem is growing. There's a cluster around Hadassah Hospital and Hebrew University's medical school. The light rail, when it's finally done, will genuinely change how people move around the city. These are not nothing.
The cultural scene in Jerusalem is underappreciated. The Mahane Yehuda market at night is a completely different world from the daytime shuk. There are galleries, music venues, a kind of grassroots creativity that doesn't get the same press as the political conflicts. Jerusalem has a soul, and that soul is resilient.
Resilience is not the same as prosperity. And Daniel's core point stands. The city is not on a trajectory toward shared prosperity. It's on a trajectory toward deepening inequality, where the wealthy have pied a terrace and the poor struggle to put plates on the table, as he put it. And the political energy is consumed by symbolic battles that don't address the material needs of residents.
That's where the municipality really does have to answer. Because the mayor of Jerusalem is not a powerless figure. The mayor controls a substantial budget, controls planning and zoning, controls the levers of daily life, And the question is whether those levers are being used to build a city that works for all its residents, or a city that serves the interests of developers, foreign investors, and political factions.
Daniel's coalition invitation, by the way. I'm in. I don't know what a sloth brings to municipal governance, but I can promise very deliberate, carefully considered decisions.
A sloth mayor would be fascinating. The city council meetings would run for days. But honestly, the pace of municipal decision-making in Jerusalem is already pretty slow, so you'd fit right in.
I'll take that as a compliment. But seriously, the question of what a better Jerusalem would look like is not mysterious. It would look like a city where a young professional can find a job without commuting to Tel Aviv, where a family can afford an apartment without leaving the city, where a hardy man who wants to work can find dignified employment, where a Palestinian resident can open a business without a Kafkaesque permitting process, where the public sphere is shared, not contested, inch by inch.
Those are not utopian demands. They're the baseline expectations of a functioning city. The fact that Jerusalem fails on so many of them is a policy failure, not an inevitability.
I think about Daniel coming from Cork, which he describes as the second city to Dublin, with a bit of a chip on its shoulder, a bit of a slower pace, but a real sense of place. And he lands in Jerusalem, which is also a second city to Tel Aviv, in economic terms, but with the infinitely more historical weight. And he's trying to make a life there, to contribute to its betterment, and he keeps running into walls. Not because he's doing something wrong, but because the system is not designed for people like him.
That's the tragedy. Jerusalem attracts people who are idealistic, who feel drawn to something larger than themselves, who want to be part of a story that matters. And then it grinds them down with bureaucracy, with economic stagnation, with sectarian conflict, and a lot of them leave, and the city is poorer for their departure.
The question Daniel ended with, whether there's a path away from extremism and inequality towards shared prosperity. I think the honest answer is that there is a path, but it's narrow and it's uphill. It requires leadership that prioritizes economic development over symbolic politics. It requires a national government that invests in Jerusalem, not just as a capital, but as a living city. And it requires a civic culture that values coexistence not just as a slogan, but as a daily practice.
It requires honesty about the problems. Daniel's prompt was painfully honest. He talked about Jewish extremism, about the salary gap, about the luxury developments, about the sense of being unwanted as a secular resident. That honesty is rare. The official narrative about Jerusalem is always about unity and flourishing and eternal capital. Acknowledging that the reality doesn't match the rhetoric is the first step toward changing it.
There's a phrase I've heard applied to Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, and the earthly Jerusalem. The heavenly Jerusalem is the ideal, the symbol, the city of peace. The earthly Jerusalem is the place where people live, with all its mess and conflict. The problem is when the heavenly Jerusalem is used to paper over the problems of the earthly Jerusalem. When you're told that everything is fine because Jerusalem is eternal, while the actual city is hemorrhaging young families and failing to provide basic economic opportunity.
That's the tension Daniel is living. He's invested in the earthly Jerusalem, he wants to make it better, he sees the potential, but he also sees the gap between the rhetoric and the reality. And that gap is not closing.
If we're going to offer a takeaway, it's that Daniel's frustration is grounded in facts. The economic data backs him up. The migration patterns back him up. The poverty statistics back him up. He's not being cynical. He's being clear-eyed. And the path forward, if there is one, lies in treating Jerusalem as a city first and a symbol second. A city where jobs matter more than monuments, where affordable housing matters more than luxury towers, and where the people who live there are prioritized over the people who visit or invest from afar.
That means the municipality has to change its priorities. It means the national government has to see Jerusalem's economic health as a strategic interest, not just a budgetary afterthought. And it means the residents of Jerusalem, the people like Daniel, have to keep pushing, keep organizing, keep demanding better. Because the alternative is a city that becomes a museum with a poverty problem, and that's not a city at all.
A museum with a poverty problem. That's a brutal summary, but not an inaccurate one. And it's a choice. Jerusalem's future is not written. The city has survived sieges and destructions and divisions. It will survive this. The question is whether it will thrive.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, naturalists in Papua New Guinea observed that the acoustic properties of bee waggle dances varied between colonies, with distinct vibrational dialects emerging in hives separated by as little as 15 miles of dense rainforest.
Bees have regional accents. I'm going to need a nap to process that.
Somewhere in Papua New Guinea, there's a bee with a very strong local twang that other bees find incomprehensible. Thank you, Hilbert. This has been my Weird Props. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. If you want to dig deeper into any of the topics we discussed, you can find show notes and more at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My Weird Prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.